and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome, everyone. We're glad to have you join us today. The Morro Bay Open Space Alliance is putting on this free webinar to educate and help stimulate a good discussion about an important emerging issue in our fair city. My name is Glenn Silloway. I'm the co-chair of the Morro Bay Open Space Alliance. I guess the title of this could be Toro Coast Preserve and the Plans for the Future of the Panorama Lots. I mean, there's a number of things going on here. They are all connected. And I think that by the end of this presentation with a truly qualified panel that we have, you're going to be well informed about this issue. The way we're going to run this is we got a lot of responses from the registrants about the questions that they were going to ask or what they wanted to learn about. And we tried to consolidate those into a set of the kinds of questions that will help our panelists reveal what you want to know. In addition, there's a Q&A function. It's a text function, and you are welcome to use it anytime to submit a question. We will accumulate those, and when we get to the end of the panelists' presentations and some moderated questions that Noah's going to bring to the table, we'll try to get to as many of those as we can. They're often duplicative, and there's going to be a lot of them, I hope. So we may not get to everybody, but we'll do our best. I think that's about all you need to hear from me. I'm going to turn it over now to Noah Smuckler, who is the co-chair, my co-chair, and he's going to engage with the panel in getting into the topic. Thanks.
You're muted, Noah.
Thank you. So as you may notice, I haven't been all that active in Zoom meetings since everything's gone on with the pandemic. And just to note, when we started talking about trying to help the community learn about this event and what's going on with the Toro Coast Preserve, the idea was to host something in the community, most likely at Del Mar Park. And that kind of shows just how long ago that was, because pretty quickly after that, the pandemic reared in and things started changing. And of course, when we look at 3,000 plus acres owned by Chevron and all the different players that are involved and the complexities of this process, it has taken quite a bit longer than originally anticipated. So with tonight's meeting, our intent is to help everyone learn more about what this process has brought to our community and what we could expect going forward, and to give another forum alternative to the city council meeting, which will be coming up on Tuesday, to learn more and then hopefully have a little more of a casual setting where you have a chance to ask some follow-up questions and then be that much more aware of the different details as we get to the council meeting on Tuesday and then going on into the future. So did want to thank all the audience and registrants for submitting questions in advance. It helped us put together some what we think is a pretty good compilation to capture the main interests for people. And tonight we're going to start with a couple presentations of our main presenters, who I'll be introducing in a second, and then following those presentations, get into some Q&A. So as Glenn mentioned, feel free to send those in, and he's going to try to field those and see what we can do here in about 2 hours or less. So just to launch right in, I'm going to introduce Daniel Bowman. If you can, give a wave, Daniel. Daniel's the Deputy Director of the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County, and his love of outdoors led to a degree in ecology and systematic biology from Cal Poly. He followed that by work with the California Department of Fish and Game and the Nature Conservancy. During his progressively responsible work with the Land Conservancy of SLO, he has brought many conservation actions to success, with the Pismo Preserve being the most recent one. Daniel is now engaged in work with the Toro Preserve, and we're really glad that he's focused on that, considering how well the Pismo Preserve has worked out. We also have tonight, and thankfully, David Fitzgerald from Chevron, who is he's our senior real estate consultant with 28 years working for the Chevron Corporation. He has been working on Central Coast projects since 2016 and is in SLO frequently. We also have tonight's Mr. Scott Graham, who's joined the City of Morro Bay planning team in July of 2014 and has served as the Community Development Director for the past 4 years. And as the Community Development Director, Scott oversees the city's planning, building, and code enforcement divisions. And then we also have, thankfully, Mr. Bruce Gibson, who is, of course, our second district supervisor here in San Luis Obispo County and has been so since 2006. He's worked on the Toro Coast Preserve since the beginning of the project, and he belongs to and participates in many conservation organizations, including the Land Conservancy of San Luis, the Cayucas Land Conservancy, and the Hearst Ranch Conservation NOW. And he was, of course, on the board of the LAFCO for 10 years. So we have tonight a great panel of different perspectives for this project, which I mentioned is pretty complex, but we hope tonight with the panel's time, we're going to be able to shed some light on the details here. So just to launch right into it, we thought Daniel would be able to give us the best overview of what the Toro Coast Preserve actually is and means, and the conservation goals and details of this first phase that is starting to come to fruition here. So Danny, if you wouldn't mind launching into a bit of background and review of what we're talking about.
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And it's my pleasure to be here this afternoon with you all. I will do my best to answer some of the questions that came up in advance. And then as Noah pointed out, we can always field those sort of throughout this as well. So a little bit of history here, going back at least five, probably even more years than that. David, you can help me when you're up. I had the pleasure of sitting down and meeting with some folks over at Chevron who expressed that Chevron as a corporation was beginning to look at dispossessing themselves of a variety of land holdings. Of course, in this case, we're talking about their shore plant at Toro Creek. We quickly took interest in the property at 3,000 acres. It is a spectacular piece of land or a holding of land. Beyond that, though, it actually plays some very significant and important roles within the community that we wished to preserve beyond just its open space value. One of those that I'll point out right away is the ability to continue to have community distinction between the communities of Morro Bay and Cayucos. When we see this throughout, notably in Southern California, but oftentimes infill development can happen and it can essentially close any gap that exists between two communities, thereby sort of losing or at a minimum blurring the distinction between them. Chevron has served the lands, you know, Chevron lands there between those communities has served de facto as a really good community separator, and it has allowed those two communities to really remain distinct. And I think that there's a lot of benefit to that. Moreover, we wished to secure and make public or bring into public ownership the parcels that are west of Highway 1 that form affectionately the to the public the access points for what people consider Dog Beach. Dog Beach is a much beloved public use area, and we wanted to formalize and bring into, as I say, public ownership those lands west of the highway to ensure that Dog Beach is preserved and the access to Dog Beach is preserved into the future. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, was Dog Beach really threatened in terms of access? And it's debatable as to whether or not that could go away. What is not debatable, however, is some of the additional benefits that comes along with securing those parcels. Most notably, and Bruce, you might be able to speak to this as well, the county has been working really for years now, going through environmental review and so forth, to create a class one off-highway trail or pathways, maybe a better way to say it, that would connect the communities of Morro Bay to Cayucos. Such a pathway would be immensely popular and very, very valuable to get people safely off the highway and allow them to move between those two communities. That pathway is really only possible by physically securing those parcels and bringing them under community ownership. In this case, we're looking at that ownership being divided between the county of San Luis Obispo to the north those parcels that butt up against Cayucos. And then what will be before your city council in Moraban Tuesday will be the acquisition and subsequent transfer to the, or the acquisition rather, by the city of Morro Bay of those southern parcels. That will allow us to, and the county to move forward on the eventual construction of that pathway. Of course, it goes without saying that there are numerous ecological benefits to preserving open space. But beyond that, there's an immense capacity for recreational opportunities, new recreational opportunities of a size and scale that I think is going to be just truly spectacular for not only residents, but visitors alike to the area. It's my hope that we could implement something similar to the Pismo Preserve here on these properties, wherein the communities of Morro Bay and Cayucos really serve as kind of launching points for this world-class open space. What we have seen in Pismo Beach, right at the doorstep of the Pismo Preserve, in conversations with hoteliers and the like, and businesses and so forth, is that business has really stepped up and boomed, even through quarantine and COVID and the pandemic and everything else. People continue to recreate an open space and use it with some regularity, and it really has brought some prosperity to those communities. And I believe that the same could be said here eventually for the larger acquisition. As I mentioned at the onset, we've been working with Chevron for five, probably more or more years now, to identify a plan as to how we might start to eat the elephant, as it were. 3,000 acres is a lot of land, and we needed to be pragmatic about an approach. I don't think we are in the market to buy all 3,000 acres, but we want to target and look at specific acquisitions that we think will best serve the community with our limited financial resources. We broke those into phases to make, one, some headway to show Chevron, frankly, that we're capable of doing this, also to help them with parcels that are ready to sell so that they could move those pieces off their docket and into county ownership for some of the reasons I had already mentioned. And then we will look at future phases when both Chevron is ready to sell those parcels and when we're ready financially to really enter into agreements. As it's currently constituted, I think we're looking at three, potentially four phases, ideally three, that would bring, right around 1,000, maybe a little bit proud of 1,000 acres under community conservation. The idea there would be that those parcels making up that 1,000 plus acres would be for recreational access, like we see at the Pismo Preserve, something probably 7 days a week, that would have mountain biking, equestrian, hiking, trail running, all those types of things. It is anticipated initially that there would be two primary points of access to this once complete. I know there was a question about Del Mar Park. It is true that the parcels we'd be looking to acquire, one of which would butt right up to Del Mar Park at Alvapal Creek, which would provide just an exceptional point of access. We do recognize that it is not an unlimited point of access, meaning there's only so much vehicular traffic and so forth that can support. But it's worth noting that also as part of the acquisition, we also hope to acquire what Chevron refers to as the shore plant, which if you've driven down Highway 1 on the right-hand side or the inland side of the road, you see the road old facility there. Once acquired, that would provide more than adequate, I think, parking. It's already a fairly heavily disturbed area. There's a lot of pavement, frankly, and parking there now. I suspect it could hold several hundred cars the way it stands today. Those two points of access, I think, would be our primary points of access. Again, this is looking out into the future. There's the third potential point of access as well off of Highway 41 that, if we're successful, there's an easement that could potentially convey traffic to that back portion of the parcels as well. Let's see. So I mentioned 1,000 plus acres. Of course, there's a fairly significant price tag that can come along with that. So a little bit about how we typically fundraise around these things. The Land Conservancy and the sort of consortium of other land trusts, which includes the Cayucos Land Conservancy, MBOSA, and historically it has included and probably will continue to include to some degree the Trust for Public Land, have all written grants in support of this project to a variety of state agencies. Those state agencies are essentially administering monies that are derived from bond sales that feed into our proposition. So Proposition 1, Prop 68, and so forth, all set aside monies for projects like this. And they administer those grants. The State Coastal Conservancy and the Wildlife Conservation Board both came in on phase one of this project. More on that in a moment. And we anticipate that they will continue to support the larger acquisition effort as we go. So there will also need to be a fairly robust community philanthropic element to this. We're hoping that collectively the larger community, not only the smaller beach communities, but San Luis Obispo and some of the larger communities as well, will help with some of the lift on acquiring these. So stay tuned for that as that develops. I don't want to just continue talking for too long, but I will just sort of end by saying, as I mentioned, we're looking at this, I'm just going to continue to call it about 1,000 acres, give or take. We've talked about it as a three-phase project, more or less. We are currently in phase one. I would describe what you're taking up here at your city council to be sort of the second half of phase one. First half already closed. That closed almost a year ago now, April of 2020, wherein we acquired what was referred to as parcel one, but it would be the northern large, about 250 acres north, just north of Toro Creek Road, and the 12 acres more or less to the west of Highway 1. That was acquired back in April 2020 and subsequently transferred to the county of San Luis Obispo. The remaining coastal frontage, we are working with a state grant to close that out. That will go into the city of Morro Bay ownership. And then I am also working currently with the Cayucos Sanitation District to acquire the last two small pieces, two parcels inland of Highway 1 to complete phase one. Phase one, we are poised to wrap up here with your meeting, hopefully Tuesday night going well. We have all the financial resources we need to close that escrow quickly with the CSD in Cayucos. And then I will move over to work on those other two lots, likely to close those by third quarter or so of this year. Then we will go into phase two, more or less right away. I'll be working with David Fitzgerald, who you're going to hear from here in a moment, to identify how we will start to piece those remaining parcels out, which ones are ready to be sold, and so forth. Dave, I'm sure you're going to talk a little bit about the remediation process and what I mean when I say ready to be sold and so forth. We have already started to walk the grounds, we being the Land Conservancy and the Cayucos Land Conservancy and Chevron, to look at potential trail alignments and so forth. So phase two is more than just a dream. It's we're already getting pretty real about it. Maybe I'll leave it there. I'm going to be here the whole time. So as questions pop up, Noah and or Glenn will feed them to me if I'm the appropriate person. Otherwise, I'm happy to hand it off back to Noah. And I think you're going to introduce our next speaker, correct?
Yes. Thank you, Daniel. And excellent overview. And I know David has some maps available to everyone, because when we talk about 3,000 acres and all these different areas, it's really important to be able to picture it. So I would like to open the floor up to David, give you a chance to tell us a little bit about Chevron's perspective and objectives for the project, and really give us a better understanding of just how much of this privately held property, including tens of existing parcels, maybe even more, exist, and help us just overall understand what we're dealing with here.
Right. Do you want to pull up that the map if you could?
And no, that would be for AGP if possible.
Actually, I think Glenn is sharing this one.
Okay, got it. Thank you. So basically, based on Daniel's nice overview there, you can see all the lots that he's described. So Chevron sold, 14 lots altogether. The lots are highlighted kind of with no color. They're just outlined, the ones that we've sold. And then we've also sold all the lots that are in blue as well. So that was the phase one conservation transaction that we talked about, are the ones that are in blue. The ones that are just highlighted are ones that we sold to local ranchers and to the Cayucas Sanitary District. So lots 8 and 10 were sold to the Cayucas Sanitary District for their new plant. And that's kind of near where that number 9 is on this map here. And so that's being built currently. And I'm not sure where Rick Kuhn is on that transaction, on that development, but it's pretty close to, it's pretty well underway, is what I would say. All of the lots that were sold along Toro Creek, most of the ranch lots were ranch properties to begin with, right? So we had ranchers that were grazing on that property and ranching on that property prior to this, and we sold them to either the rancher that was on there or to somebody that was going to continue to use it as a ranch operation. So for the most part, there hasn't really been much change on Toro Creek by the sale of those properties. And then, when you start looking at the biggest thing that's gone on is this, the sale of lot 1, which is the sale to the County Parks and Recreation. So it puts almost a mile of beach in the hands of the community. And then it also has that community separator that Daniel was talking about as a key factor of acquiring that piece of property. So I think it's good for the community, because that way you're only really kind of buying that property that's the most critical, and then the rest are in uses that you can live with. So that's one of the things that Daniel had mentioned to us, that he didn't want to buy all of it, but he wanted to buy those ones that are the most select and that it had the highest kind of driver for the community. So we've successfully kind of closed on the sale of phase one that Daniel had talked about. It puts, again, that community separator out there, and then it allows you to have the benefits of having either the dog beach and the bike path available for the future. And so that's available to you now. And so what we're then trying to do is then move to phase two, which is highlighted in yellow on this map. And that's kind of working off of Del Mar Park, lot 41, 39, 17 South, and 32 South. So that's a significant area. It's probably in and of itself, it's close to 1,000 acres. And in addition to kind of what's we've already sold in blue to the community. So, and that, when we talk about parking, I think, when you look at 32 South at the very top over by the Dynegy property, there's another access over there. So there are other benefits to the community by owning that property. It's beautiful. It's got oak woodlands, and it's kind of like a hobbit land, I guess, up there. It's pretty nice. So that would be a great benefit for the community. One thing that we have to do prior to selling that property, we have an above ground pipeline that runs along Alvapal Creek there. And we've removed about a third of it already, but we still need to remove two thirds of it. And again, it's above ground It's in some pretty sensitive areas in terms of along the creek. And so we're working through the local permitting process to have those pipelines removed. And once we remove those, then that will kind of open it up so that we can sell those properties to the county parks and recreation for further benefit for the community. We are looking to sell all of the property. So like Chevron's benefit, or, you know, the whole thing is we'd like to eventually sell this whole property and to put it into reuse either by the community or others. But we'd like to, get out of it because we've been in, you know, probably owning this property for the last 100 years. And we're no longer operating there, and we'd like to eventually, you know, resolve kind of any remediation that's required there and to then put that into the hands of somebody that can work with the community and development or open space. So we're okay with open space. We think that's a great use. We just want to make sure that, you know, there are costs that we have to pull out pipelines and do remediation, and we're looking to offset some of those through the sale of some of the lots. So the panorama lots are listed in orange here, and our goal is to sell those to a developer at some point. And when I say a developer, it's somebody that can work with the local community and the placement of the homes there. We've agreed that we weren't going to allow any homes to be above the 200-foot elevation there. We feel like the view corridor and whatnot is important. And so we've heard you on that. But at some point in the future, when we sell it to a developer, they're probably going to work through the local planning process to have the actual placement of those homes kind of established, because, you know, there's ravines, there's slide areas or whatnot. And we're not planning that. We're not dictating where those homes are going to be. We're hoping that whoever buys that is going to work with the local community in terms of placing those homes and placing them in the right position so that they are able to use the local kind of, they fit in with the local area and topography. So that's kind of the main thing. And this next map kind of shows what the yellow areas are, is the kind of the 200 foot elevation. And so we've said, hey, we're not going to have any homes built above kind of the yellow area, and we're going to limit it to one home per lot, according to the ranch zoning that it's currently zoned for ranching and or ag use. And so we're not going to push for more than that. And we're going to leave that up to the community to work with an individual developer for the actual placement of those homes. All right. So that's kind of generally my spiel on that. And if there's any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thanks, David. And just to get into a little more detail on just how that process would go as far as the development of the panorama lots, and talking overall big picture from the city of Morro Bay's perspective, we have Mr. Scott Graham tonight. And Scott, if you'd like to go ahead and give us an overview of what you're seeing from your side, from the city of Morro Bay and the planning.
Hi, thank you, Noah. I have a presentation, so I'm going to share my screen. Give me a second here. Can you see the presentation?
Actually, we see the presenter view. If you could go to your display settings there on your Zoom side and go to swap displays.
There we go.
Thank you. Thank you. We do see another presentation.
Okay. Okay, so as everyone's been saying, we've been working on this for quite a while. It's been a lot of entities involved with it. It's been going on for 5+ years. You know, the entities that have been involved, you know, through the process have been Trust for Public Lands, Cayucas Sanitary District, Cayucas Land Conservancy, obviously Chevron, Land Conservancy San Luis Obispo, Morro Bay Open Space Alliance, Coastal Conservancy, County of San Luis Obispo. And through this, we, in looking at how we were doing the preservation component based on the Dog Beach piece and looking at the backdrop of the city for the panorama lots, we came up with a non-binding memorandum of understanding in January of 2020, where CSD, Chevron, the city, and Trust for Public Lands signed on. That MOU sort of spelled out how these different moving parts would work. There's about four main tenets of the MOU, which are sort of represented in the action that the city council will be taking on Tuesday. The kind of first piece of that is the acquisition of Lot 6 Southwest, which is the southern portion of Dog Beach. That's the portion that's located within city limits. And it was previously owned by Chevron, but sold to the Cayucas Sanitary District, I think, in 2019. And so that purchase would take place between the city and the CSD. And that is one of the things being requested for authorization, is to enter into a purchase and sale agreement with the CSD. That's one of the things being requested at the council meeting on Tuesday. The second component of this, and one that I would imagine a lot of folks are very interested in, is the amendment to the city's sphere of influence and bringing in the five lots that sit above panorama that you saw on David's slides previously. Again, we've been talking about this for quite a while, and this process is sort of, you know, paralleled the city's update to its general plan and local coastal program. And in that draft document, there was a lot of concern expressed about what the development potential was for these lots. And there was a significant desire to preserve the slopes that sit as the backdrop of the city and leave them undeveloped. And so the draft sphere of influence in that document includes these lots as well. And I'll, at the end, I have the same map that David showed you, and we can bring that back up as well. These lots are owned by Chevron. It is Chevron's desire to have them annexed into the city. The sphere of influence amendment is kind of the first part of that, and the annexation would then follow. Each lot would accommodate a single family home. We would be bringing them into the city with the same zoning classification that they have in the county, and that's agriculture. They would be limited again to a single family home for each lot. And then the homes, as was indicated by David earlier, would be restricted to those lower portions of the property. And we don't have developmental footprints yet. As David stated, you know, that would come later as they do the environmental analysis, look at slope stability issues. And there's also the potential that, you know, you do lot line adjustments and locate the homes, you know, group them in an area that can be developed. So those are sort of options that would come forward later in the process. As part of this, the Cayucas Sanitary District is interested in detachment of their Lot 6N, and I'll show that on a map here in a minute. It's the sort of the northernmost lot in the city, and it has on it the Cayucas Sanitary District lift station, so their sewer infrastructure. So they'd like that lot to be taken out of the city's jurisdiction and placed back in the county. And so the actions that the council will be taking on Tuesday include that authorization as well, meaning to submit an application to LAFCO, Local Agency Formation Commission, for a detachment of that lot from within city boundaries. Sort of the last piece is the purchase of that lot 6 Northwest, that northernmost Dog Beach lot, and that is not in city limits, but it is in the city's sphere of influence. The city has a very small sphere of influence. It was amended 2007. We had a fairly large sphere of influence at that time, but not the resources really to develop it. So when the LAFCO conducted a sphere review, they kind of snapped the boundary lines to the city limit lines, with the exception of the dog beach lot. And that was because the city and its citizens were very much interested in, you know, maintaining or having the opportunity in the future, perhaps, to acquire that and bring it into the city so it could continue in perpetuity to be used as dog beach. That is also included in the city's actions that would be moving forward on Tuesday, and that is to enter into the purchase and sale agreement with the CSD for the acquisition of that lot. We would follow back and go to a future council meeting and seek authorization also to submit an application to LAFCO for annexation for that property, assuming they authorize the purchase and sale agreement on Tuesday. These are kind of just to orient you. They're similar to the maps that were shown by David earlier. I have the 6 Southwest lot. They don't look like the shapes that you see there in 6 Southwest. They're shaped differently than that, but the 6 Southwest is about 9 acres. The 6 Northwest, the one that's outside city limits, is 6.27 acres. And then again, the intent is to, locate the development on the panorama lots in the area below the approximately below the 200-foot contour tour interval. That's the area shown in yellow on the screen there. We don't, again, have specific building footprints at this point. That would come later as the environmental analysis is done out there to look at environmentally sensitive habitat, to look at the slope stability issues that exist out there. And then out of that would come, building footprint areas where homes could potentially be developed on those lots. And we would also, there'd be a view analysis that would have to be conducted related to any development on any of those lots as well. And I think that's my last slide. This is just an overall view, but I think David's map was better than this. So I think I will leave it at that. I can't stop sharing my screen here.
Okay, actually, I think it, if possible for Zeke or one of the presenters, as we continue on and get into question and answer, if you can leave one of those maps up, either the broader map showing the entire property or perhaps even getting into a specific, more focused map on panorama as we get into those parts of the discussion. So a couple of questions have already rolled in, and we had these also submitted earlier. One of the primary questions is, well, the future of Dog Beach, you mentioned that it would be managed by the city in the south and then also by the county in the north. If Scott, if you could speak to that, and then I'll pass it over to Mr. Gibson to talk about what the county's perspective would be on the management of their portion of Dog Beach. But Scott, if you wouldn't mind describing what you see the city's approach to Dog Beach being once that's acquired. And
we're actually, as part of the funding sources coming from the State Land Conservancy, required to develop a management plan for the beach. So that would cover, trash pickup, things like that, what types of uses could be out there, that type of thing. And so we would be putting together a plan, following acquisition that would outline what those would be. And that would be a community process. So we would have public input to that, public hearings, that type of thing.
Okay. Do you see a situation where Dog Beach is most likely managed somewhat similar to Morro Rock Beach being managed by the city? I know there was some concern about limits on or state park type management of the Dog Beach with the transition.
Yeah, I mean, the intent, by the city acquiring Dog Beach is to allow it to be operated as, continue to function as it does today, to allow dogs on the beach in that location. I mean, obviously, it's been a huge issue for the community for a very long time. And again, it's why that area is actually in the city's sphere of influence, is because the community came out when they were going through that sphere review process and said, we want to have that piece in the city at some point in the future. And so when it came out of that sphere review in 2007, that piece was left in the city's sphere of influence. So that could take place in the future because that was the desire of the community. And I think LAFCO, listen to that and then allow that portion of it to remain. So
great. Thank you. Mr. Gibson, if you wouldn't mind speaking to the county portion and just overall what you've seen with the discussions about Dog Beach being one of the primary goals of the project.
Sure. Thank you, Noah. Thank you for having me here. Absolutely. There are a whole lot of reasons to preserve what Daniel aptly called this world-class open space. but Dog Beach rises right to the top of the list. It's, you know, everybody who's here this afternoon knows it's immensely popular. And the county's interest in acquiring its lands, and I do think it would be helpful maybe to start to have David's first slide up that shows the overall view there so we can do it. But the county has acquired the northernmost 250 acres at the coast, including the land west of the highway. And our vision for that on west of the highway is to keep Dog Beach operating as it has for so many years. It's a tremendous recreational value among all the reasons, as I say, to conserve this land is to preserve that particular recreational opportunity. So we are indeed, our county parks department is working, you know, has been working, will be working more as the city of Morro Bay secures its portions of Dog Beach. And we look forward to a joint management plan that absolutely lives out the desires of the community. You know, I think it's worth pointing out there's a in the blue. So the county now owns lot one, which is a little hard to see, but that's the west of the highway and the big piece at the very north end there. As you go down Dog Beach, you'll notice that there's a piece that's not colored blue. That's a piece that Chevron's going to retain so that they can do what they need to do about remediating the loading lines and things like that. But the beach in front will continue to be used just as it has for so many years. And I'm excited to be part of this project.
Yes, thanks, Bruce. So if we can follow up a little bit with you on, and actually I think it would be really helpful overall if we just leave the map up and available because it is so helpful and there's a lot of moving pieces here, but Bruce, you've had such extensive experience with LAFCO and planning and looking at this project. If you could help us look or consider what you see as the next steps from the city's perspective and then also from the county perspective on what this project means, because they're obviously Chevron being a private property owner of a massive amount of acreage, they have plenty of options here. So if you could talk us through some of the different angles that you see and challenges with this, but also opportunities that we have with the project and how you could see this developing as it goes forward from here.
Absolutely. So LAFCO is the acronym for the Local Agency Formation Commission. It's a body that every county has. On that commission are seven members. I'll just give you a little background. Two county supervisors, two representatives from cities, two representatives from special districts like community services district or sanitary districts like Cayucas, and one member of the public. And the job of LAFCO is to manage basically the jurisdictional lines of different agencies within the county. So that is the body that decides on where city limit lines are, what's in a city, what's outside the city in the unincorporated county. It decides what's the service area of a special district like the Cayucas Sanitary District. And that's governed by a state law called the Cortese-Knox-Hertzberg Act. And it tends to be a fairly detailed sort of wonky bit of business. But its intent is to have orderly development. Its actual intent is to conserve land for purposes like open space or agriculture. And it was brought forward, I believe, the original legislation back in the 60s to prevent cities from just sprawling out over the countryside. So the interaction between right now, all of Chevron's property is in the unincorporated area of the county. So land use decisions there are under the purview of the Board of Supervisors. And the actions that are going to be before the city on Tuesday in a couple days are meant to start the process by which LAFCO would give more control of the land use decisions and the management of land to the city of Morro Bay. So for instance, the annexation of Dog Beach into the city of Morro Bay, it's currently in an area called its sphere of influence, gives the city the authority to regulate what goes on. Well, now, as it turns out, the city's going to own that property, so that should be an easy thing. The city limit actually extends all the way up to Toro Creek Road in a very funny kind of narrow strip, and you can see a little bit of a pink magenta-like line right up at the very far northeastern side. That little rectangle inland is going to be moving back to county jurisdiction because that's the property that the Cayuga Sanitary District has. The lots that are sort of an orange-brown color, the panorama lots, are being proposed to go into the sphere of influence of the city of Morro Bay. That's an action that presages the possibility that those lots would be incorporated within the city limits of Morro Bay. And the reason for doing this is that the city of Morro Bay would like to have control of the land use decisions on those lots. Now, that again is a process that takes some public hearings before LAFCO. But what the city will do basically is lay out its vision of how it wants to see these lots develop, which is the same vision that Mr. Fitzgerald of Chevron articulated. They will be pre-zoned, if you will, to allow one single family house on each of those five parcels. And with that, the city at some point, and Scott Graham is probably the better person to speak to me, to that, at some point the city can apply to annex those in, and thus the city will have control of the land use decisions. So all these moves between the city, the county, all happening through LAFCO in this instance are aimed at accomplishing the conservation vision of the Toro Coast Preserve.
Great. Thanks for that. And just a quick question regarding process. Do you see a scenario where the parcels would be sold prior to annexation and then the city's planning process goes through that before annexation? Or what are the steps there? I probably could go multiple different directions, but if you could help us know.
Let me just say two things. When the parcels are sold are really in the hands of Chevron to decide as the property owner. But one of the things about having the sphere of influence conveys influence to the city through the fact that the city and the county have a memorandum of understanding that talks about how we are going to jointly approach land use decisions in the areas that are considered sphere of influence or anywhere near the edge of the city limits. So I would certainly, to me, this being such an important part of this conservation effort, because those panorama lots can be protective of the first line of scenic protection there, that beautiful ridge line that frames the backdrops, the north end of Morro Bay. I don't see any reason why the county, well, let me put it differently. The county and the city are on the same page as to how those lots should develop, and that's consistent with the lots zoning as it is in the county right now.
Okay, so potentially the lots, it's really Chevron's call as to when the sale would occur,
right. Exactly.
And to whom.
Right.
And David, as we had talked previously, you are anticipating a scenario where those lots are sold together to a developer to provide more flexibility to that developer to target areas that are more stable and better fit for the neighborhood and for access and so forth. If you wanted to talk just briefly about that, and we'll go to Scott to talk a little more about details of the panorama planning process.
Right. I think from our perspective, we'd like to sell those lots as soon as we feel that we've got like a plan to move forward, right? So I think, we have kind of a plan that says, hey, there's a good chance that these could be annexed into the city of Morro Bay. And there's a desire to have control over the land use planning. So we'd like to sell the lots as quickly as we can at some point after the it's added to the sphere of influence for the city of Morro Bay. But if it doesn't come about, then we might have to, you know, work it further down the line for annexation. For the most part, we'd like to try and sell those.
Okay, great. Scott, if we can talk a little more about details of what the future of Panorama would look like. As we all know, the island streets and Panorama in general are, the road conditions are challenging, particularly on Panorama, narrow streets. We have seen historic geological instability in some areas in particular. Those are primary concerns for a lot of the neighbors. Traffic with a fair amount of pedestrian and community activity with the density of homes there have historically been an issue. So what sort of protections are there to help the neighborhood feel like this new development is not going to turn their community or the neighborhood into reduce the quality of life and create a potentially dangerous situation, whether that's traffic or geologic issues with landslide and so forth concerns?
Yeah, that's a good question, Noah. As we get down the road further, this would, you know, be a development would take place out there and would be evaluated, after the sphere of influence change was made. We'd start looking at it as part of the annexation process, but really it would get probably, the most defined when, as David indicated, when, you know, they sell the property off to somebody that's interested in developing it, at which point they'd be going through, if it was annexed into the city, a discretionary review process that would involve planning commission and the city council. They would be coming through with their, you know, biological studies, all their environmental work. They would look at slope stability and try to identify areas on those lots where they could put footprints for homes. And then they would also, as part of that analysis, determine how they were going to access those lots, meaning from the surrounding network of streets. Is it from Panorama in some instances? Is it from some of the other streets that surround them, depending on what lot you're looking at? That would all sort of come out of the mix when those studies were conducted. They're not going to generate a significant amount of traffic because it's five homes, but you would want to know, we would want to look at how they're accessing the road network and where they're doing that, because that would need to be done in a safe manner. So those are the evaluations, again, would take place through the discretionary process.
Okay, and then we've had some questions regarding paying their fair share with new development. You know, we're aware of the impact fees for any new development. So no matter the size, there's certain requirements and expectations for that development to pay its portion of what it's going to be utilizing for city services. Could you talk a little bit about how that might be in play with the Panorama lots, particularly seeing the geologic concerns and maybe increased traffic for that neighborhood? How those lots could cover those new impacts?
I mean, you mentioned it in the very beginning of the question, and that is, they'll pay impact fees. Impact fees is how people buy into the system. And those impact fees would cover things like related to traffic. So for streets, they cover, you know, things like police and fire services, those types of things. And so impact fees would apply to the development of those individual lots, and they would be paying those fees as part of that development. Okay. And so impact fees really is just what I said. It's you buying into the city system, basically.
Mm-hmm. And we know that because of the housing crisis in California, there have been quite a few adjustments and new restrictions on what communities can do to dictate how and where development occurs. The state really wants to try to address the housing crisis. In some cases, that's really helpful for communities. In other cases, it reduces our ability to influence decisions. And in this case, what would you see in terms of zoning for those lots? And with the size, we're talking as they are now, most likely 5 units. And then as almost every other larger lot in the community has the opportunity to, we could expect ancillary or accessory dwelling units potential for each of those lots, given their size. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, so accessory dwelling units would probably be part of the mix. The state has, over the last several years, stripped away discretionary authority as it relates to accessory dwelling units, only in very, you know, you have to make some sort of environmental finding that it was inappropriate to have them in these locations. And I don't know if that could or couldn't be made, you know, because we're not at that point yet. But realistically, the state's moved to that, you know, again, stripped away the cities and counties' abilities to prohibit them in most facets. They really have made them almost by right. And that was on purpose, so that it did provide the housing that the state wants us to have, and it removes barriers to providing that housing. And so that's sort of where the state was coming from in doing those things. But it's unlikely that we would have the ability to prohibit them.
Mm-hmm. So most likely we have those 5 lots there. There could be adjustments, lot line adjustments, to particularly in a planned development situation, to try to target the best locations for that development. But because of the 5 lots, most likely each would have the potential for a smaller secondary unit as part of their property.
Yeah, smaller secondary units, sometimes referred to as granny units, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
And similar restrictions that come with those would be offered to any lot in the community that wanted to develop a granny unit or a secondary unit.
Correct. We would be hard-pressed anywhere else in the city to prohibit them as well, just because of the state's, you know, changes that the state's made to the laws over the last few years, really making them by right, so.
Do you see those lots remaining zoned agriculture, or portion of those lots, in the future?
I think that's the way we would leave them, agriculture, and then with the specific, you know, ability for them to build a single home on each one, and with the ADUs. We don't want any more development of that, and really focusing on restricting the developable portions of those lots to the lower areas, because we don't want, the whole reason behind bringing these in is so we can dictate where the development goes. We want to maintain the backdrop of the city as open space, open hillsides, not with homes and structures and those types of things on them. So we would want, you know, all of the infrastructure that goes into putting a house on a lot on those lower parts. That means the access points, the roads, water and sewer lines, all that stuff takes place down there, not up on the slope. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we know that in that area, the Panorama Tank property has caused quite a bit of concern and debate in the community. Could you talk just a little bit how this is different or similar to the Panorama Tanks, which are not owned by Chevron, but have been pursued by a separate developer, and how you could see this being different, or what you've learned from that process?
I would say, you know, largely the issues we had with the Panorama Tank site were the result of the owner. Every problem that we had out there was a direct result of decisions he made. And so you can't pick who's going to buy the Panorama lots. Chevron can, but we can't. I think that's a very unique situation there. I would not, most development that takes place in the city, we don't have issues with. We'd had some with that because it was difficult dealing with, you know, the owner of that property. He, you know, would follow the rules for a while and then would, it was difficult, and it involved created a fair amount of angst in the community over there. And I understand that. But I don't foresee that being the issue here. Somebody's going to come in and work with the city to develop what those footprints look like for the homes, and where that makes sense. They're going to develop a plan for access and for the infrastructure that would go along with the homes. They're going to work with the city in doing that. That'll be an entirely public process that the citizens will get to weigh in on. So, it's not like this is happening behind doors. This is happening out in front of everybody. So they'll get to, you know, watch it from, you know, step one to step five, you know, when we, you know, from the beginning to the end, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question regarding the lots, and everyone's obviously really intrigued by the potential recreational value of phase two with Alva Paul Creek and the trailheads, potentially out of Toro Creek and Dog Beach and Del Mar Park and maybe even off 41. There have been some questions about knowing the size of the panorama lots. If there'd be an opportunity for the community to have actually an easement through a key section of those lots to grant potentially earlier public access or alternative public access to break that out. As we know, if you live in the northern section of Panorama, it's quite a hike down to Del Mar Park or over to Dog Beach. So is that something the community could potentially ask for and through the negotiations potentially acquire? That's kind of an open question to, I guess, either David or Scott.
I would say that it's not something that has been brought up previously. Really, the idea was to preserve the backdrop. We didn't really talk much about having access, you know, public access to these areas. You know, certainly it's a discussion that we could have, though. That area is beautiful. That property all along, you know, the stretch above Panorama and even going further back into the phase two areas is amazing. So I could see why people would want to have access there. So,
right. But that property is currently leased to a grazer, a cattle grazer. I mean, and it's good to have a cattle grazer out there. It keeps the grass kind of chewed down from a fire perspective. So that the property is actively being grazed. And so having people accessing this area when the guy's cows are out there probably isn't the best thing at some point, but I could see once we sold it, then maybe the potential buyer would be willing to provide access to the community there. But for now, there's probably no kind of opportunity for community access. Just, we also want to keep people out from where that, you know, the hill plant is. And so, you know, and there's not really a defined trail that cuts through the side of the hill there. So I would probably say no until the buyer is involved, and maybe that buyer is responsible for the grazing as well and that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. I would probably say it's not an opportunity at this point.
But potentially down the road as part of the negotiations and review with the community.
Right.
Just a quick question to Daniel, then on the bigger perspective of management for the phase two Alva Paul Creek and then sweeping around through the tank farm property, hopefully. How would you see that working, knowing we have the county, the city involved, the Land Conservancy, and a lot of other conservancy groups? And everyone is pretty strapped with resources, but we've seen it done well in Pismo, and how would you see it coming together here as far as management of that property once it's conserved, if we get that far?
Sure. Well, how about when we get that far? I'm going to manifest this right away and just say that I am confident, especially given the state's interest in this property and their interest in expanding the availability of public open spaces like this, especially in otherwise really impacted and overly expensive areas where, you know, people don't get to necessarily recreate in this kind of really fantastic environment. That being said, the Land Conservancy is not only in the business of acquiring land, but you know, being stewards of the land as well. We prepare stewardship plans for every property that we manage. In this instance, I anticipate that we would work in partnership with both the county and the city to identify those stewardship concerns, including the necessary resources to take care of these things, and try to identify what and where those things are and where we might get those resources. I don't have a sort of silver bullet idea right out of the gate, but you're right. I mean, there are very real ongoing stewardship concerns that come with these things. However, I think that those things are manageable and that they are worth taking on when you consider the benefit that acquiring these lands and bringing them into public ownership would do. Again, the economic benefit of bringing an open space like this adjacent to a community like Morro Bay cannot be overstated. We see this already in the communities that are at the doorstep of the Pismo Preserve. And it may well be that such additional stays at hotels and things like that bring in sufficient extra revenue through TOT and other things that maybe a small allocation could be made to help with care in that way. This is just one idea. I'm not saying it's the only one, but there are lots of ways to approach this. Private philanthropy is another one. Did I get to your question, Noah?
Yeah, I think so. And of course, we do have quite a volunteer base in our community, a spirit of volunteerism and a lot of enthusiasm throughout the Estero Bay trail maintenance and care. So
yeah, that's actually stepping up. Yeah, I'm remiss in not actually saying that on the Pismo Preserve, the volunteer trail crew and stewardship team that we have assembled there is exceptional. And I anticipate we'd get something very similar to it here in the local communities. But they really are the backbone of what we're able to do and help implement at really low or essentially no cost, other than the material costs of things, a lot of the ongoing trail maintenance and so forth. And of course, as part of a stewardship plan, we always identify the most sustainable trail alignments at grades and so forth that are designed to last and be durable over time, right? They're not always the most thrilling as a consequence from a mountain bike perspective, for example, but they do tend to lend themselves to very sustainable trail systems and ones that I think offer the most well-rounded experience for the sort of the largest suite of visitors.
And one thing we've seen used all over the state and definitely successfully at the Pismo Preserve is to try to help coexist the different uses, one-way trail systems and limited trail access for certain users like mountain bikes, which can be pretty intimidating for walkers. But did you want to talk a little bit about how that could work?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are challenges that just abound with access, right? I think that when we talk about access, we want to make sure that we're providing as much accessibility for as many people as we can. One-way trails offer really good opportunities to mitigate negative interactions because everybody's at least going in the right direction. We actually switched over to that at the Pismo Preserve for COVID as part of our response to make sure that people are actually going in one direction to minimize the amount of times that people might be passing each other on the trail. With a property of this size, there's no end to the ways that you might, you know, create a trails network, whether that's specific for specific trails just for walkers versus mountain bikers, or whether they're one-way trails or what have you. This all needs to go through a pretty rigorous process of sort of walking those alignments and really sort of field fitting them and testing them. I might actually chime in on one of the Q&A questions, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Since we're talking about the panorama lots now in sort of a larger context, one of the questions that was brought up, and I'm going to paraphrase this, I don't have it right here in front of me, was essentially, you know, why not bring the panorama lots into conservation? And I think it's a fair question. Certainly, you know, I tell people when I meet with them, and I'm positive, I told this to David Fitzgerald, that the goal of conservation is to get the most for the least. you know, that really is the strategy that I try to employ here. If I thought that it would have been possible to acquire all 3,000 acres from a grant writing perspective, I would have aggressively pursued that. But I had to take when I say I mean the conservation groups in general, we have to take a more pragmatic approach to conservation and really look at reasonably, what do we think we can fundraise around with the state and through private philanthropy? And then given that number, where are the parcels that best suit the community in terms of providing that community separation, providing that ecological benefit that I talked about, but really also providing those recreational amenities? The panorama lots they're spectacular to look at. So there's no doubt that they contribute a lot to the viewshed of the community. But from a visitor serving standpoint, they're very challenging lots. They're quite steep. That point has been made several times here on this. So there really is no way to sustainably create a trail alignment across them or over them. So I really think that as a use just simply goes away. The second thing is, because ostensibly there is the ability to have limited development there, they carry a price tag with them that is frankly a little higher than some of the other parcels might on a per acre basis, just because of that. You know, when we do appraisals, an appraiser is going to look at the so-called highest and best use value. And whether we like it or not, the highest and best use value for property is always going to be associated with development. Because there's albeit limited development potential here, but there is development potential here on these lots, and because of how steep and challenging they are from an access standpoint, it really doesn't make a lot of sense for us to put significant resources into those to the exclusion of others when we really can't use them for enhanced public benefit. Another way to say that is, if I have only $10 million to play with and those lots represent, you know, 2 million, I'm just going to pick a number, it's an arbitrary number, but don't otherwise, beyond viewshed, have a public service to them, or I can spend that $2 million on lot 41, which abuts Delmar Park and the creek, I'm getting significantly more a return on that investment from a conservation and from a visitor serving experience standpoint. There's just a simple math equation at the end of the day of moving numbers around the ledger to say, for our dollar, where can we get the most? Now, if any one of the 63 participants on this has some money in their pocket and they feel like they want to contribute that towards acquiring the panorama parcels and put those into conservation, I will happily take that your dollars, and I will happily buy those lots from David Fitzgerald, and I'll see that no development ever occurs on those. That really is as simple as it is. It's just a matter of dollars and cents. I would love to buy it all. But with what I think that we can do, we're taking a pragmatic approach.
And so just to reiterate, that would include the sphere of influence with restrictions that limit development to the lower portion, lower third, as it's stated, and the majority of the viewshed being preserved. So it sounds like you and the negotiation group really tried to get the best you could out of those lots and then grant development rights, which already exist for those lots, similar to what went on with the other ag parcels up Toro Creek. One of the questions that has been raised is, does this set a precedent for future ag owning property owners? And are we creating an opportunity or an example that would then encourage other ag property owners to pursue development? There's a concern there that this is going to stimulate people to want to develop their ag lands, and I could see where that concern comes from, but it does appear that this is actually reducing the development rights of Chevron, who could pursue other avenues here. But if any of you wanted to speak to the different scenarios here, maybe that you've seen in other areas where communities don't come together and be proactive like this.
Yeah, if I could know it, this is Bruce. I think the key here is that folks with legal parcels have certain development rights, at least assumed. They have to go through a process to see that development happen. But The matter of taking the panorama lots into the sphere of influence of the city of Morro Bay and eventually annexing them so that Morro Bay asserts its land use authority is really part of realizing the conservation values of these properties. And you touched on it before, that the understanding is that what development occurs on those parcels will occur low, and it is explicitly for the preservation of that scenic backdrop that the land use regulations are formed. So if there are other parcels near the city limits of the city of Morro Bay where that same value can be realized, it's a conversation that can be had. But I think the real key to understand is that business of doing what's proposed here is really in the control of the city to realize a vision that its community members want to see realized.
Thank you, Bruce. Anyone else want to address that?
Well, I guess I would say this. I mean, this is we've been talking about this now for 5+ years. And this was a very unique opportunity, right? I mean, we're all sitting here, we're all on this call, you know, because Chevron was going to divest themselves of these properties, you know, 5-6 years ago. And, you know, all of the folks that are on this call engaged to look at what the opportunities were out there to preserve some of that property. I don't see that being, you know, elsewhere, you know, in the city of Morro Bay on its exterior. I mean, certainly there are other areas that are backdrops to the city. And I think, you know, Bruce made a good point that, you know, maybe if there's something that's similar or value, somebody could approach the city and ask, but it's entirely up to the city on whether we annex property or not. We don't have to have the conversation if we don't want to. We're having the conversation here because we get something out of it. And that is that we preserve the backdrop to the city in perpetuity. That was important, you know, and this happened through a public process. That public process, the conversation anyway, happened as part of the update to the general plan. You know, we've had probably going on 60 meetings between general plan advisory committee and planning commission, where land use was discussed, where the sphere of influence was discussed, and it's shown in all the maps that are in the general plan. So, it was a fairly well vetted concept. And people came out and were concerned about what could happen out there as far as development went. And could we end up with development that sits further up on those slopes? Potentially we could. This is one way that we can make sure that it doesn't.
Thanks, Scott. David, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I think everybody should keep in mind, you know, like Daniel was saying, that risk is low just because, I mean, the lots are 213 acres. And I think the footprint of the 5 homes, even with ADUs or whatever, are going to be, you know, well less than maybe, you know, 4 or 5 acres, right? So you're getting 210 acres basically of open space, right? I mean, so with the current plan. So it's really preserving a lot of space because, you know, I mean, 5 homes on this size. I mean, I think that we kind of measured the linear feet along Morro Bay, and it's like 1.2 miles from the edge of lot 33 all the way to Delmar Park, basically. And that's quite a bit. It's not dense, right? You know, I think if it's done smartly, you know, and working with Scott and the planning team, I think it can be done well. And it can be done so that the community, hopefully the community can live with it. So that's what I'm, as a Chevron, you know, and I don't live out there, but I think it's, you know, from our perspective, we'd like to sell it. And we've talked to smart people like Daniel and whatnot. And so we're working with you to make sure that you can get what you want out here. And I think you're getting a lot in terms of the amount of open space out of the 213 acres. Only a very small portion is actually going to have any kind of development on it.
Okay, thanks for that. One question that was raised was the annexation process. City does, this will be for Mr. Graham, the city does have a voter initiative component to any annexation based on a prior voter initiative requiring that. Could you talk a little bit about that and, you know, how this is going forward following the sphere of influence, if that does pass on Tuesday, how the annexation process would look from the city perspective?
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason why we weren't processing the, you know, the those changes through council at the same time, meaning annexation and sphere amendment, was because of that voter initiative. That voter initiative took place in 1980 and requires a vote of the citizens to annex property for anything other than public purposes. But for public purposes, we can just go, we could annex it but without a vote. But this would not be for a public purpose. And so per that measure, this would have to go to a vote of the citizens. Now, the thing is that it's the concept that's within that measure has sort of been, I don't have a great way to say this. Like, it was voted on by the citizens, so it exists, and the city council can't change it or remove it without a vote of the citizens to do that. But the concepts that are in it, meaning that the citizens have a right to vote on whether something's annexed or not, is not within the purview, and that's been determined by the courts. So it's the process that we go through moving forward. We need to kind of look through that carefully, because it really gives the authority to either cities, counties, and then WAFCO agencies are the only ones that can determine the boundaries for cities. Voters can't. There's a few, I would say there's a couple of exceptions to that, but they don't apply here. So we haven't gone through and had that conversation with council yet, about how they would want to move this forward to the next phase, meaning annexation. It is complicated by that measure, but again, the courts have determined that those types of voter initiatives cannot be applied to annexations, those limitations. So pretty confident on that. We've had numerous conversations with LAFCO. They also agree. So this is sort of a to-be-determined piece, and we debated internally, you know, whether to include a significant discussion on that or not in the staff report that went to council on Tuesday. The decision was made not to. We will discuss it. I'm sure it will be raised as questions during public comment, but there isn't a discussion in the staff report because we discussed it previously and decided not to put it in there because there's so many options about how this could move forward that it was complicated and it was going to be making that staff report all about that and not about what we're doing. And so we didn't think that was a great process. And it's probably better to have that conversation later when we do go through the annexation process and the authorization is to speak to, you know, what are the opportunities and options to deal with the measure as we move forward, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be kind of on, I guess, but the point is it needs to be on its own. It was convoluting. This is already convoluted enough with all the moving pieces, and we didn't want to make it all about that. So we chose not to go down that that road as it relates to the staff report that was prepared. So,
and I'm sure the attorneys are licking their chops when it comes to that particular item from all different sides. So,
yeah,
I can understand taking one step at a time here. Speaking of steps, there's been a couple of requests for the lot line adjustment potential or easement through Panorama. Looks like lot 34 in particular has garnered some interest, and basically, just for the record, sounds like there are members of the community that would really like the idea of some degree of easement and access through Panorama as part of the planning process. If possible, that would be something that a couple of commenters have submitted so far, and I've heard beforehand as well. I'm looking through the questions here, and I think we've done a pretty good job of getting to what we had pre-written before the workshop. We're going to start to probably wind this down if we don't hear any new questions from participants I would like to perhaps open it up for each of you if you had something, thought or closing statement that you'd like to make, something that you felt like we missed to speak to. We do have a little more time, but I don't want to just speak for the sake of speaking. So why don't we go ahead and just if we don't see new questions coming in, start to wind this down and give each of you a chance for some closing thoughts and comments on this, and then we'll end with Glenn summarizing everything and closing this out for the evening. So Daniel, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Yeah. No, well, hopefully by now you have gotten the impression from me that I am very much in support of this larger project. I think that what we're endeavoring to do here at Toro Creek Preserve is just exceptional on a variety of levels. I think it really hits not only all the good kind of ecological benefits, but really is true community conservation. And I think it's really well positioned to serve your local communities very well from a local visitor standpoint, but also really help with your local economies and just providing truly world-class open space for you all to enjoy. So I don't really have a lot of additional thoughts to add. I'm happy if there's anybody else who wants to reach out to me, you can certainly find me at the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County, and I can help with any questions you might have about the conservation aspects of this.
Thank you. David, did you want to close with any last thoughts?
Yeah, I would just say that we've been super successful at closing the phase one conservation lots. And I think it just opens the door for us to finalize the phase two conservation lots, which will then lead to the phase three lots. So I think the long game is really going to be super beneficial to the community. I think we've already been highly successful, and I think we've built a really great relationship and trust among the team members. So I'm super happy with that. And I'm just looking forward to phase two, where we can unlock, Avapal Creek and all of the trails opportunities up there, because the community is going to really enjoy that area and its beautiful views and all the things that you could hope for from a open space. So I'm really excited about that and unlocking those opportunities. And so I look forward to working with the team going forward to do that. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. It wasn't easy coordinating with everyone's schedule, and each one of you represents quite a few interests around the county and then also globally. So we really appreciate your time and focus here in Morro Bay. Scott, and then we'll wind down with Bruce and then Glenn.
Thanks, Noah. I want to thank the Morro Bay Open Space Alliance, both Noah, you and Glenn, for putting this together. This opportunity to provide information to the public, I think it was important. I think it was a great idea. I very much appreciate you doing this, especially with the pending item coming before City Council on Tuesday. Definitely good to get information out there ahead of that. Focus on this sort of phase one of the conservation effort. I think it's done really well, and if the council moves forward with the items that are in front of them on Tuesday, we'll have preserved Dog Beach, and hopefully taking the first steps to bring that into the city. We have the Lot 1 acquisition by the county that kind of creates that separator between Morro Bay and Cayucas, and that'll forever be there. I think that's fantastic. This certainly would pave the way, for the Morro Bay to Cayucas multi-use trail connector. I think that's fantastic. This would also, move forward toward preserving the backdrop at the northern end of town. So those are all very positive things. I mean, I'm super excited to be part of it and to be moving it forward. So I think that's probably where I would leave it.
Great. Thank you. Bruce.
Thank you, Noah. I too am incredibly excited about this opportunity. My friends who precede me have spoken to the values, the results that this is going to bring about, the partnerships and the relationships that have been developed over the years that we've been developing it. And that's where successful conservation happens. The number of entities and individuals that have been involved in this is extraordinary, and my thanks go out to them all. The landowner Chevron, through David's leadership, has come to embrace this conservation vision, which is just huge, and that comes from a deep sense of trust. Various government jurisdictions, from the Cayuga Sanitary District to the city, the county, and the state funding agencies, who are tremendously excited. We have able nonprofit land trusts that are deep into this, Trust for Public Land, the County Land Conservancy, the Cayucas Land Conservancy. And then finally, that last piece is the community, which supports this. And Mbasa has been great. I know that there are a whole bunch of people out here who are incredibly excited to see this happen. Yes, Dog Beach will live on forever, and much more is going to happen beyond that. So again, a great pleasure and honor to be associated with this, and looking forward to the next phases. And I will turn it back to you, sir, and with my thanks.
All right. Thank you all. And Glenn, if you wouldn't mind sending us off for the evening with some closure.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you all very much. It was a informative discussion, and I hope that people picked up a lot. We got a lot of questions that didn't get specific answers. We're going to print those out, and I'll distribute them to all of you. If you see something that you can answer, we'd appreciate having some feedback so we can send it to our participants. Thanks especially to AGP Video. They did a great job, Bob Lloyd and Zeke Turley, behind the scenes, making us run smoothly. I want to say one of the first things that I did as I joined the Open Space Alliance was to set up a meeting with Daniel Bowman, and we talked about conservation. He started teaching us about how conservation works. And he said a couple of things that have always stuck with me. One was, you think in terms of decades, not years, when you go through conservation agreements, because there's a lot going on. We're trying to negotiate some complicated trade-offs. And the other thing was, and this seemed counterintuitive to me at the time, but he said, every conservation deal is a deal for development. But what you're trying to do is get the most appropriate and least development you can to preserve as much of the open space as you can. And that's what Mimosa's mission is, to preserve the open space in and around Morro Bay. We think that these kinds of projects, as complicated as they are, we hope will end up with the kinds of benefits that we all are looking for in conservation. Phase two, with the Uvapal connector and all those trails up on top, most of you probably haven't seen this. I've been fortunate to go up there a couple times. It's an amazing opportunity for us to work through that. So I hope we can just count on you to stay in and help us do this. Take a look at the Morro Bay Open Space Alliance. That's www.mbopenspace.org. If you can join or support us in some other way, we'd appreciate it so we can continue to keep this work going forward. Phase two is going to be a heavy lift, and we're going to need everybody to be involved to get that. I'm going to finish here by saying we are recording this. We're going to have a recording either on our website or in another appropriate location. We'll let you know. I believe that AGP Video is going to put it on their, what is it?
Slow span.
Slow span, is that it? So you can look for this to see it again if you want. The link will be available for you, for the public. You can pass it along to anybody you want to be informed. And pay attention to the Morro Bay City Council on Tuesday night. Starts at 5:30 p.m. And they'll be discussing this issue on an important decision for the council to make. So with that, again, thank you, and stay tuned, and we will be here for you. I hope you'll join us, and we'll go forward from there. Thanks.